Hey, Hillbillies, it's Jerry. As most of you know, it has not been a very good year for me health-wise. Tracy and I are trying to raise some quick capital for a personal project. Now, this project has nothing to do with the podcast, but it will make our lives much easier. We will be able to share many more details with you around Christmas time. Now, in order to make this happen, we have a great deal for you guys. For a one-time fee of just $100, we are giving you a Hillbilly Horror Stories t-shirt, a personalized Hillbilly Horror Stories book, a 15-minute video call from myself and Tracy, or a video call from Santa to your kids, because I've got a really good Santa suit. And last but not least, this is the biggie, lifetime Patreon membership at the highest level. So what exactly do you get for your membership? Well, you're going to immediately get over 1,670 bonus shorts. That's right, 1,670. You're also going to get over 140 full-length bonus episodes. You're going to get every Hillbilly Horror Stories episode that comes out ad-free. And then every month thereafter, you're going to get 24 short bonuses and 2 full-length bonuses per month, along with all the ad-free episodes. What would you normally pay for that? The Patreon alone at that level costs $180 per year. You're going to get it for a one-time fee of just $100, plus you're going to get the shirt, plus the book, plus the video call, and we're also going to include free shipping. If you want to take advantage of this offer, and trust me, it will make a great Christmas gift for a listener, just go to hillbillyhorrorstories.com to take advantage of the deal. It's only going to be available until December 31st. We did something similar to this 4 years ago, and the people who bought the lifetime membership have already gotten almost $800 worth of Patreon episodes for the $50 that they paid back then. We love you guys, and we can't wait to share this information with you.
Done fell right down that rabbit hole, so
reality is questionable.
Try, but you just can't let it go. These two right here put on a show. It's paranormal overload with southern hospitality. Haunted murder mayhem tip while discussing immortality. Locations with a dark past, history that comes to life. Hillbillies with a knack for everything that goes bump at night. Overthinking if you're by yourself, these two will have you turning on the lights. Mixing in a little comedy to make sure it all fits in just right. Hey.
Welcome to Hillbilly Horror Stories. Now here's your hosts, Jerry and Tracy Punk, and their dog Ninja,
and sometimes their cat Freddy, but never the ferrets.
Hey guys, welcome to episode 384 of Hillbilly Horror Stories. I'm Jerry.
And I'm Tracy.
We'd like to start off by thanking everyone for listening, and we want to wish every one of you guys a Merry Christmas, if that's what you celebrate. I am sorry, I forgot Hanukkah like a couple of weeks ago, a couple episodes ago.
That's
I should have
true.
Said something about Hanukkah. It was earlier this year than mm-hmm. I expected it to be, and I missed that, so I apologize if you celebrate Hanukkah. And if you celebrate Kwanzaa, I think that's the day, it starts the day after Christmas, so.
Dude, I don't know what the deal is. It doesn't even feel like Christmas. I don't know why. I don't know if it's the midst of everything going on and we got so many things in our brain or something, but this is like, oh my God, like Christmas is actually tomorrow. So it's really weird.
We love it. Yeah, we want to thank all of our military and civil servants all over the world, no matter which country you represent. Thanks to all you men and women and service animals for everything you do for us.
Absolutely. You guys are amazing, wonderful human beings, and we appreciate you all so daggone much. And I hope you can enjoy, if you're not with your family, enjoy your family where you are. And we love you so much.
That sounded odd, but I get it.
Well, you know what I mean. Like, celebrate with the family you're with.
Yeah, like if you can't be with the one you love, love the one
you're
with.
Love the one you're with. Okay, anyway. But yeah, definitely. You know, because they are totally family. So, forget it. Y'all know what I'm saying.
Let's just move on.
I'm sorry.
Tracy, there's a...
Merry Christmas.
I've been looking at my timeline on Facebook the last couple of days, and there are a lot of people just really having a rough time. There's been some deaths out there in friends' families.
Oh, man, I know.
And, you know, it's just, like I said, it's a tough time anytime you have a death in the family. But when it hits right at Christmas time or Christmas Eve even, like I've seen a couple today already, just know if you need to talk to someone, there's no shame in talking. Don't keep all that stuff bottled in. It's a sad time when you lose somebody close to you.
But. Yeah. And we've heard quite a few. Nick, I wanted to say, if you're listening, that we're sorry to hear the loss of your mother. It's a horrible time of the year. Any time of the year is horrible. But, you know, from the reviews I've read, I've never met her, but she seemed like she was a wonderful, wonderful lady who was loved by all. So God bless you guys. We're thinking of you. So you guys can contact Jerry or I if you need to speak about anything, anytime, day or night. You can also go to the group. There's so many wonderful people in our group, and they're there to always lend an ear or whatever they can do for you guys. You also can call the crisis hotline at 988, and you can text at 741-741, but please reach out if you need somebody.
All right, Tracy, tonight we've got a cool story, and we've also got a couple of extras. We've got Morgan from Michigan. If you listen to the Patreon bonus episode that just came out, she had some stories on there, but we've got a lot longer conversation with her with stuff that wasn't on that one. That was like little bonus stuff she did for us. Also, we want to thank Tragedy of Cinema Podcast. They do a little Christmas bonus every year, and they invited us to be a part of it for... I think they've done three or four of them already, and we're actually going to play. That came out a couple of days ago. If you haven't heard it and you want to hear all of it, go to Tragedy of Cinema and listen to their Christmas special. But we're going to play the one we did tonight. It's a little short one, 3 or 4 minutes.
Yeah.
But we'll play that on here, too, since it's Christmas time.
Cool.
All right, Tracy, on this Christmas Eve, we are going to discuss Lincoln Park. It's one of the oldest neighborhoods in Chicago.
Dude, I thought you meant the group. I'm like, what's going on with them?
No, the band was actually named after Lincoln Park, but not that one.
Oh.
There's a Lincoln Park in Santa Monica that I think Chester used to drive by all the time and thought it would be a cool name for
a
band. That's how they did it.
Oh, so. I had no clue about that. Surprise.
Lincoln Park is a park, but it's also a neighborhood in Chicago. It's actually... one of the oldest neighborhoods in Chicago with tons of history. So it's not surprising that there are a few ghosts making themselves known in the area. So Lincoln Park is 1,208 acres. It's located just off Lake Michigan.
Dude, that's huge.
It is. It stretches for 7 miles through Chicago, starting at East Grand Street and going to West Aardman. It's the second most visited city park in the United States, only behind Central Park. It also contains the fourth oldest zoo in North America. We're going to talk more about the zoo a little bit later. So obviously, we're here to talk about the ghost of Lincoln Park. And we'll touch on history as we go on this one instead of giving it all up front. Because I think it's you'll see that it kind of fits if we do it in sections like that.
Can't wait.
Today, we're not only going to look at the hauntings of Lincoln Park neighborhood, but the aforementioned Lincoln Park Zoo. So let's just start off with the park itself. So the land where the park sits was the original cemetery for Chicago. They had to eventually close this as a burial ground because of how close it was to Lake Michigan.
Oh.
And I mean... close. Like if you saw old pictures from back when this was a cemetery, it's like the beach from Lake Michigan stops and the cemetery starts.
Dang, how do they do that?
Well, they didn't apparently. So it was causing issues and we'll get into those. The process was to start moving the bodies up until October 8th, 1871. That was the night that the great Chicago fire hit.
Dude, I was just thinking that when you said that, I was thinking, the night Chicago died. Is that the song for that?
I don't know. I don't remember if that song was about the fire or not. It might be. I can't remember all the words.
That's exactly what I thought of as soon as you said that.
So later when they went back to try to find out where all the bodies were buried, they had no idea. And we're going to talk again more about that later.
I mean, how would you even start the process of that?
Well,
you're going to tell me, right?
Not really.
Oh.
Because back in the 1800s, there really wasn't much of a process for that. They couldn't use sonar or any of that stuff to be able to see where the bodies were. So those bodies basically are still there. At the south end of Lincoln Park, near the Chicago History Museum, there's a mausoleum with the name Couch carved on the top, just like the piece of furniture. The Couch tomb is the only visible remnant left from the days when the south end was a cemetery.
Oh, wow.
Would you like to guess why it's still there?
No.
Okay.
I think you'll tell me, though.
I'm going to tell you.
I was going to try to guess, but it would have been something dumb, I'd say so.
I want to touch on the closing of the cemetery a little more. Like I said, it was close to Lake Michigan. And the cemetery opened in 1843. The last burial there was in 1866. With it being so close to Lake Michigan, sanitary conditions were very poor. Caskets were literally buried near marshlands. And when the lake levels rose, some of the bodies would wash ashore.
Well, that's what I was going to say. I mean, wouldn't some of those caskets or whatever go into the ocean?
Well, that's not the ocean.
Well, not the ocean, but you know what I'm talking about.
Yes, they wouldn't, and they'd wash right back up. Or it would knock the loose dirt off the top of them when the water raised.
Oh, wow.
The decomposing bodies also contaminated the drinking water.
Oh.
That caused several cholera outbreaks.
Oh, my God.
But, like I said, the Couch tomb is still there.
Ugh.
And it actually belonged to Ira Couch. And you're going to find there's all kinds of confusion and everything with this mausoleum. So Ira was a 50-year-old man who had a big history in Chicago, but he died while he was on vacation in Cuba. Ira had arrived in Chicago in the early 1830s. He was a tailor and a haberdasher.
What the heck is that?
It's like a tailor.
No, what a haberdasher.
Exactly. It's like a tailor.
Oh.
It's basically the same thing. It's somebody who would make men's clothes.
Hmm.
So it's along the same lines. He eventually became the owner of the Tremont House Hotel that we've actually covered on the very second episode of Hillbilly Dead Time Stories.
Okay.
So you can go back and listen to that. That place is haunted as hell. So fantastic. After Couch died in Cuba, his body was returned to Chicago for a wake and a funeral. He was then placed in a holding vault in the city cemetery. His brother James had the mausoleum commissioned 1 year later in 1858 at the cost of $7,000.
Ooh.
In 1858, that was more than houses were going for.
Man. Wish it was still like that.
I know.
Why does this cost that much? We really could have our lottery dream house.
Yeah.
For like, what,
$20,000? Yeah. The limestone for the mausoleum was hauled in all the way from Lockport, New York. And there's some mystery, like I said, surrounding this tomb. For example, why was the tomb left when all the others were moved? The answer to that may just be that it was too expensive to move the structure. It weighed 50 tons.
What?
That's what they said. It was too expensive to move. So they just left it. By 1899, the Lincoln Park Commission decided that it was impossible to move the vault, so they just left it there, and all the other mausoleums that they had were actually removed. There's also talk that Couch's body may not be in the mausoleum.
What do you think it is?
Well, it hadn't been opened since the early 20th century. And there was a man then who said he went inside when the park opened it to do some work around it. And there was a newspaper that actually reported that the man claimed that he saw nothing in there. But Couch's grandson saw the report and he disputed that. But even more mystery mostly had to do with some of the names that the grandson that we just talked about actually mentioned. The grandson said, hey, these are the people that are in that tomb. And I know for a fact. But most of the people that he mentioned are actually interred at a different cemetery. At the Rose Hill Cemetery, in fact.
Maybe they cremated his body and just still stuck it in there.
Well, I guess that would be possible. But what about the fact that there's a family plot at the Rose Hill Cemetery and they have headstones for almost every one of the people?
Except him?
No, they've got one for him, too. So that's what I'm saying.
What in the world is happening here?
That cemetery is actually several miles away from Lincoln Park, so it's kind of odd to begin with. But Ira Couch himself has a headstone there, and his wife. They both are listed on the headstone, but they're not listed in Rose Hill's documents saying that they're buried there. But yeah. They've got headstones there.
What's her name, Ima? That was dumb, sorry. Yeah, it sounds like something shady. Like they're, I guess, trying to throw people off, I reckon.
Yeah, I have no idea. Some of the oldest ghost stories in Lincoln Park started at that Couch mausoleum, though. In the early 1800s, newspapers were reporting a local urban legend around the neighborhood. It claimed that if you came to the mausoleum at the stroke of midnight, any night of the week, didn't matter, you faced it, looked at the name Couch, and said three times, the graves belong to the dead, not the living.
Then what would happen?
Well, then supposedly the door would open to the mausoleum and a big white ghost would come out and greet you. A lot of people also reported seeing that big white ghostly figure around the mausoleum back in the 1800s.
That is creepy as heck.
One last thing about the cemetery. I say that, but then I'm going to talk about it more later. This was common in the times, but it was actually divided up. There was a Jewish section, a Catholic section, a general city section for just people in the city, and then there was also a potter's field for people that were poor.
That I do not understand.
I mean, back in the day, it was pretty common that if you had a religious affiliation, it was part of your belief system that you should be buried with other members of that. So if you were Catholic, you wouldn't be in the Catholic section. If you were, you know, Protestant, in the Protestant section, Jewish, whatever.
I just didn't realize it worked that way. I mean, I thought family members are buried with family members.
Well, but most family members back in the 1700s, 1800s were of the same faith. So
that would have made sense. Yeah, that's true.
Tracy, there are roughly 20 million people who visit Lincoln Park every single year. And aside from the zoo, it has the Chicago History Museum, the Lincoln Park Conservatory, and the Peggy Notbart Nature Museum. And I don't think I mentioned this yet. Lincoln Park was originally named Lake Park because it was like, and then when President Lincoln was assassinated, they changed the name to Lincoln Park to honor him.
Oh, okay.
That's how it actually got its name.
Well, that's very nice.
Lake Park in the very beginning when it had the cemetery there and all that. The entire area of Lincoln Park has been surrounded by tales of the supernatural for as long back as the park has been around. There are stories about lights flickering in almost all of the buildings within the area, as well as doors and cabinets open and closing on their in the same buildings. Objects have been seen moving on their own accord. You know, I've noticed that spirits must be huge Honda fans. Like, they always move on their own accord. It's never like they never move on their own, you know, Tercel or their own Camry. Visitors here report the...
Those snobs, aren't they?
Yeah. Visitors here report the sensation of being watched, touched, and even grabbed by unseen presences. One of the more popular stories is about approximately 4,000 graves of Civil War POWs, most of whom died at Camp Douglas, and then they were moved to Oakwood Cemetery. Of course, they were originally buried in Lincoln. So documentation says that all the graves were actually moved, but there are rumors saying that this isn't actually the case and that some of those remains were left behind. And if that is the case and some of the remains were left, they would be under the park's recreational fields for all the kids to play on top of.
Oh my goodness.
Several witnesses over the years have described encounters with ghostly soldiers, even in broad daylight. They kind of wander around the area looking confused with Civil War clothes on. And a lot of people think they're Civil War reenactors until they go up to talk to them and they just disappear.
Oh my gosh. How cool would that be, though?
All right, let's go back to the Couch Museum the Couch Mausoleum just for a second. There is a rumor that an unidentified man who died at the Tremont Hotel that we talked about earlier is actually buried inside that tomb. And the spirit of this man is said to appear outside the tomb looking lost and confused.
That's so sad.
There's also a huge statue of Ulysses S. Grant. Of course, he was the 18th United States president. And he was a general of the Union Army during the Civil War. Well, supposedly in 1892, lightning struck that statue, killing three and injuring seven others, I guess, that were either touching it or around it. Others say that there were actually 11 fatalities when the lightning struck. Many people report cold spots by the statue, as well as whispers coming from the general area.
I just can't imagine just sitting there touching something and then bam.
Yeah. Just like those
soccer players
that we talked about.
Yeah, that's awful.
From 1894 to 1919, there was a bridge at the park. It was 75 feet tall and it went over top of the lagoon off of Lakeshore Drive. It was closed due to poor maintenance conditions, like I said, back in 1919. Some say, though, that it was torn down due to the fact that there were approximately 100 people that took their life from jumping off of that bridge. Mm. There were hundreds more who attempted, but were unsuccessful. Today, there are actually numerous reports of people running up to other people, but these people are pale and they appear to be soaking wet.
Oh.
All right, so we can't talk about Lincoln Park without talking, obviously, about the Lincoln Park Zoo. In 1868, the Lincoln Park Zoo was created when the city was gifted two pair of swans.
That's how it started, with two swans?
That's how it started. After a short time, some donations would include pumas, elks. I think it's just elk. I wrote elks, but I think it's just elk is the plural. Mm-hmm. Wolves and peacocks. Now, supposedly, there are about 12,000 bodies buried underneath the zoo because that's where the bodies were that they had to stop. So let's get to that. I said I was going to come back to the cemetery. So why are their bodies buried there? Well, we semi-touched on it earlier. I just didn't finish the thought. They started moving the bodies from the cemetery. Then the Chicago fire happened. That much we've talked about. What I didn't tell you is that most of these markers at the cemetery were made out of, guess what?
What?
What do you think the markers would have been made out of back in the 1800s?
Wood.
They were made out of wood. So what do you think happened to those grave markers after the fire came through?
Oh, no, it burned them. Oh, man.
So there was no way to know who was buried where after those burnt down.
Dude, that's terrible.
So they just put the park over top of it without moving any more bodies. They actually run into every time, like when they go to put the zoo down or whatever, and they start building, digging for buildings, they always run into bodies and have to move them. And even today, if they decide to do something in there and they dig, there's a good chance that they run into bodies. In 1874, the Lincoln Park Zoo made their first actual purchase of an animal. It was a bear cub from Philadelphia.
Nice.
The cub became well known for escaping its enclosure. They said that they would come in and locate the bear just running around the park, usually at nighttime.
Well, he had free reign. Why not?
Well, that's fine.
And he's the boss of the place since he was the first one, I guess.
He was the first one they bought. But everything else was done. But the thing of it is, he's running around in the park, like where people are.
Oh.
Not just like in the
zoo. Like at night, though, right?
Yeah, but still, people could be out walking at night and you get attacked by a bear. Nobody wants that. So anyways, 1884, the very first American bison to be born in captivity was born at the Lincoln Park Zoo.
No.
From 1888 to 1919, zoo director Cy DeVry, he built new structures and he would add an elephant to the zoo and eventually some monkeys. One well-known spirit here is a woman in a Victorian-era clothing. She's often seen around the lion house. And she seems to be oblivious to passers-by. So people go by and walk by and they see her, but it's like she don't see them. Probably a residual haunting.
Yeah, sounds like.
She also likes to manifest in the women's restroom near the exhibit. She likes to appear behind those that are looking in the mirror.
Well, at least she don't go into the men's. She's got a little respect.
This is true. There are some other random spirits that wear various clothing from all the different decades that wander all over the zoo and the park. So you will see, like you might be there today in Lincoln Park and you'll see somebody dressed in like 60s hippie attire. Or you'll see somebody wearing 1930s or 1920s clothes.
Oh, man, if only.
And
I'd give anything to see that.
They're all just spirits.
Wow.
Let's go and just dress up like hippies and walk through and let people think we're spirits. And then when they come up and talk to us and be like, hey, I like your outfit, we just ignore them. And they'll be like, they'll be telling their family, we saw a ghost today.
Oh, you think?
They could. I don't know. Yeah. They might not. Or they might just say we saw some rude, stuck-up hippies that didn't want to talk to us. The Lincoln Park neighborhood has lots of morbid history. It was actually the home of gangster George Bugs Moran. In 1929, it was home of the St. Valentine's Day Massacre. That was a turf war between rival mobs, and on that day, 7 men from one of the gangs were murdered at a garage at 2122 North Clark Street. They were mowed down by 4 men who worked for Al Capone.
Don't be messing with that bunch.
Back in 1982, there were the Tylenol murders. Do you remember that?
Yes.
A man actually laced several bottles of Tylenol with cyanide, and the first death was to a flight attendant by the name of Paula Prince. She bought a bottle of Tylenol from the Walgreens at the Old Town section of Lincoln Park. She was found dead 2 days later. And for those of you out there who might be too young to remember, that is why whenever you buy so much as a bottle of orange juice, when you take the lid off, it's got the little thing you have to peel off. Or when you open up a thing of Tylenol, it's got the silver paper over top of it that you have to poke through or whatever. Those are all there because of the Tylenol thing that happened back in the 80s. Before then, there were no seals like that in any of them. Yeah. But what he was doing, he was going out and buying Tylenol bottles, opening them up, lacing them, and then taking them back and putting them back on the shelf.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And nobody would know any difference. When he opened it up, none of them had the little, you know, they had cotton balls.
Yep.
That's all they had.
Yep.
And
that was nuts.
So now you can't, like I said, you can't open up a bottle of vanilla extract without there being some type of, you know, or ranch dressing. But that's why.
Well, I mean, but still, if they wanted to do something bad enough, they could.
Yeah, but I'm just saying, though, that was the protective measures. Now it's everywhere, and it was all because of that. So, horrible situation. The next location in Lincoln Park is a haunted restaurant. It goes by Adobe Grill. That's what it is today. This was originally called That Steak Joint.
Wait. No, that's a Qdoba. Oh, never mind. I'm thinking something else. Sorry.
The That Steak Joint, as it was once called, has one of the meanest ghosts in town. It's been known to drag waitresses down the staircase in the restaurant. Sometimes it will manifest itself as just two glowing eyes.
Oh.
She don't even get the whole body. You just can see two eyes.
Yeah, no thank you.
Psychics and mediums claim that there was a double murder that actually occurred in Piper's Alley. That's the cobblestone pathway that ran right along the building. The killer is the ghost who now haunts the eatery. At least that's what they think. A Double Grill denies any paranormal activity. So if you go there and you talk to them, they're like, oh, no, we don't have any paranormal activity.
So it's still going.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. But they say there's no ghost there.
Right. Yep.
Also in what they call the Old Town part is Michael's Church. Now, there's an old legend that the devil himself supposedly appeared in the communion line one Sunday in right around 1970. Or maybe the
early 70s. Get the heck out of here.
Yeah, he just appeared in the communion
line. Like he's getting ready to take communion.
Yeah, its problem was, though, he was cloaked in a black hood and robe with hooves instead of feet.
Oh, now, okay. And that didn't seem really weird
to
people?
Yeah, call me crazy, but I do think that would probably stand out.
Oh, my goodness.
This is also the stomping grounds of Candyman. This is where Caprini Green housing project was, and the place where the urban legend of Candyman actually started. So,
yeah.
I think we've talked about the true story of Candyman.
Yeah, I think so.
Now, the most famous ghost of Linkin Park, this will make Justin Rimmel happy, John Dillinger. John Dillinger obviously was a bank robber, and he wreaked havoc for about several months across three streets back in 1934. He was eventually gunned down just south of the Biograph Theater. They say that you can sometimes see a ghostly figure stumble and fall to the ground.
So who ended up shooting him?
Police.
The police, was it? At the, I didn't know if it was them or like a civilian.
He was going to a movie. There was a girl he was dating. And she sided with the police, became an informant, and said, look, we're going to this movie tonight. And she agreed to wear a red dress, a bright red dress, so it'd be really obvious. And when they came out of the theater, she just kind of backed away from him, and police just unloaded on him.
Wow. I did not realize that's how that went down.
Yeah, so if you ever hear anybody talk about the lady in red, that's where that came from, because she was the lady in red.
Wow.
There's a really good movie years ago.
I hate that song, though. Oh. Lady in red. Blech.
That might have been a different Lady in Red.
But well, I'm sure it is.
There's a really good
song.
Movie years ago called The Lady in Red. If somebody wants to see how all this unfolded, it was with Pamela Sue Martin. Mm-hmm. It was a blast from the past.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Robert Conrad.
Oh, my gosh.
I think he played John Dillinger. This would have been from like the late 70s, early 80s.
Wait a minute. Robert Conrad.
The guy with the batteries. Knock this off my shoulder. Remember?
Oh, yeah. I was totally not thinking.
You're thinking probably Bill Conrad, the bald guy with the mustache to play the cop. But if you get a chance to go see The Lady in Red, if it's out, it kind of shows you all that stuff. But it's a pretty good movie. Long time ago. But they say that you can actually feel really cold, icy cold spots move through your body when you're in that area where that theater was. So, anyways, that is our story on haunted Linkin Park and Linkin Park Zoo.
That was a good story.
All right, Tracy, so we're going to take a quick break. And we'll come back. We're going to play our little Christmas story that we did for Tragedy of Cinema. And then we will listen to Morgan from Michigan.
All right, sounds good.
All right, Tracy, let's first listen to the Christmas episode that we did. It's like I said, it's like 4 minutes, and then we'll come back and do the other stuff and listen to Morgan. Hey, guys, I'm Jerry.
And I'm Tracy.
And we are Hillbilly Horror Stories, and we want to say thank you to James and Kyle from Tragedy Cinemas for including us on this Christmas presentation that they do every year. And thanks to Tim for putting it all together.
Yeah, thank you guys so much. It's an honor to be on here.
Tracy, we're going to go back on this story to Denmark, the very early 1900s. So we're in an orphanage. It's Christmas time. There's a new orphan, little boy, that's been dropped off. Well, all the other orphans in the facility are telling him how great it is at Christmas time. On Christmas Eve, there's going to be a beautiful tree up. It's going to be lit with candles all over its branches. There's going to be a beautiful fragrant stew. It's going to be so much better than they normally eat on their daily basis. And the very best, at the end of the day, they're all going to get their own orange.
Aww.
And this is all made possible by someone in the community that you know, donates the oranges and all that stuff.
Okay.
So the little boy's excited. First of all, he's never seen a Christmas tree.
Never?
Except through somebody else's window. He never had one in his house.
Aww.
And then you talk about an orange. His very own orange. He's never tasted an orange before. He smelt it because at the marketplace, he was able to get close enough to smell one. And one time, he was even able to run his finger over the skin of the orange to be able to see what it felt like.
Well, bless his heart.
So they're excited. Christmas Eve comes just like he was told. The tree's up. It's beautiful. There are candles everywhere. They had lamb stew. It was some of the best food he had ever had. Fresh baked bread. And then he starts seeing everybody line up for the oranges. He lines up, takes his place. The children are going through. They're getting their orange. They're saying thank you. And then as he approaches the headmaster, who's actually giving up the oranges, he stops and looks him in the eye and he says, "I'm sorry, son. We're out of oranges. Aww. We took the count before you came here."
Mm.
And he said, "But you'll get an orange next year."
Aww.
The little boy was so upset. He ran upstairs, crying, throws himself on his bed, buries his head, and just sits there and cries. A few seconds later, he feels a slight tap on his shoulder. He tries to stop crying long enough to turn around. As he's doing so, he feels a stronger tap. And then he feels somebody pull him up from the bed. He smelt it before he seen it. But sitting on the bed next to him was a cloth napkin with several orange segments. Each one of the children had taken a segment from their orange and given to him enough to make a complete orange.
Well, how sweet was that?
So the whole moral, obviously, to the story is to remember that Christmas is a time for sharing.
Absolutely.
And there is nothing that will make you feel better than sharing something you have with someone that doesn't have near what you might have.
Agree. Well, that's a wonderful, wonderful story. And God bless those kids. How amazing is that?
And so that's our story we have for you guys. Hope you have a great holiday season, no matter which holiday that you celebrate. And come give us a listen at Hillbilly Horror Stories.
Bye, guys.
All right, Tracy. So we want to just a quick mention that the Patreon special we got going on for Lifetime, there's one more week of that left. That runs through the 31st of this month. We want to thank everybody who's already taken advantage of it. We appreciate it.
Thank you guys so much.
Yeah, it's been a huge help, believe it or not. I do want to mention, though, that if you haven't gotten your shirt or books yet, it's because I'm still waiting on books, and I guess Christmas has slowed everything down. Normally, when I put in an order, I will get those in a week. And now it's been 2 weeks, and I still haven't gotten them. They're saying they're supposed to come next week. But I promise I'll get all those out to you as soon as possible.
Of course.
Tracy, what do we got going on over there?
Well, we have a lot of wonderful reviews, and we can't thank you guys enough. We have Mojo Lobster, S.K. Morris 007, Sam Farrell, J.N.S.C., Jason B., Spiders from Mars, Deshaun W., and Lethrop Jen. Thank you guys for your reviews. They were so very kind.
S.K. Morris, I have lost the message that you sent to me. I can't find it. I know you're wanting to do a video call. Send me a message again, and we'll set that up for next week.
Yay!
What else? We did some Santa video calls. They were cool.
We did. We did that. Our Patreons for this week is Adriana and Don Birch. Thank you guys for your support. You guys are truly amazing. We can't say that enough about you all because we feel so blessed, and we love you guys. Just thank you again.
If you took advantage of the Lifetime Patreon, we're going to read all of your names.
Yes.
Once the thing ends, we'll do all of them at one time.
Right, right. So now I have to go. And because you guys have been that wonderful. We appreciate y'all, and we adore you all. So thank you so much.
Absolutely. All right. Let's listen to our friend that we met at Crypticon, Morgan from Michigan. Hey guys, I am with Morgan from Michigan, and Morgan, you and your friend actually came by our booth at CryptidCon, and we talked for, I don't know, 15 minutes or so, 20 minutes. You have a fascinating story that is generational. It goes all the way back for you, to your grandparents, and goes all the way up to your son. I thought it was absolutely a fascinating story, and I thought it'd be fun if you came on and shared it with your listeners, and you agreed to. So thank you for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's do this. give our listeners a little bit of background as to what this story entails, at least.
Okay. So like you said, it's generational UFO sightings or alien encounters. To start with, my grandfather, he was in the Navy. He would drive the U-boats for World War II. And he would talk about how he saw lights. And then my parents, they actually have an abduction experience. And then mine happened about 23 years ago. And there was missing time during the sighting, so possible abduction there as well. And then my son, he had an alien encounter.
You know, so. It's funny that you say, you know, you make the comment about it being generational, because that there is a lot of UFO stories where that's the case. It literally is something where somebody says, hey, I think my family all the way back, you know, maybe in some cases even farther than what you're talking about, it just seems to be they're the subject of these UFO encounters. Why do you think that is?
I honestly have no idea. I just started exploring into it. I actually talked to Andrea Perrin about it as well. And she says she thinks that it's because we're hybrid. She believes that we are hybrid Arcturians. So honestly, I have no idea. I'm just now exploring into it. I'm just now, thinking about doing, regression therapy to see what exactly happened, because prior to now, I kind of just wanted to have it as a happy memory, because I always looked at it as, well, it was either aliens and there's someone looking after us because they could have done a lot of damage, or it's somebody visiting from the future and I guess we survive everything that they throw at us. So either way, I kind of looked as a positive ordeal. But you know, in doing regression therapy, there could be a reason why I don't remember, but it's something that I'm looking into now.
Is that something that Andrea suggested that you do, or is that something you just did on your own?
It's something that Andrea suggested along with another psychic that was at UFOCon in Michigan.
Okay. So obviously this goes back generational. Let's start with your grandfather and some of the stuff that he saw. And then we'll just move it down to your parents' abduction story and then to your story.
Okay. Yeah, no problem. My grandfather, he never really got into great detail about it. He always used to tell us he was in the war for the potatoes that they had. And so he kind of just made light of it because we were young when he talked about it, but he used to say that he'd see orbs all the time at night. And, so that's where that one started. And then with my mom, she said that orbs would always come into her room as a kid. And it was kind of a constant thing. And I'd ask her, well, what color were they? I'd always ask a lot of questions. And she said, well, they'd come in through the window and they'd trace the line of the ceiling and go above me. And she said that they'd range in different colors. And then when her and my father were dating, which my father, he was in the army. When they were dating, he was about 19 and she was 20, 21. They lived, or they'd go and visit up in Harrisville, which is northern Michigan. And we had a cottage on Lake Huron. My mother, she'd like to get up before sunrise and go and watch the sunrise over Lake Huron. And one morning they did this and they're laying there and the sun's starting to come up and they saw a bright light come across the water and then zip to them and then shine a beam on them. And then they woke up on the beach again. Oh, and wow. Yeah. And so my parents, they haven't gotten along for over 30 years. And that's the one thing that they both will agree on is like, it's word for word the same. And my dad, he believes that they still track them. We had a conversation about it on Thanksgiving because I told him I was coming on here. And I told him like, well, is it something you ever want to look into or anything like that? He's like, well, he's like, it's not over. They know where I'm at. And I was like, okay.
your grandfather who had the experiences, is that on your mother or your father's side?
That's on my mother's side.
Okay.
Yeah. And then, but that was the only experience that I know of on my father's side is my father's abduction experience. But yeah, and their stories are the exact same. And they said that theirs was a white light because I'm always really asking a lot of questions about the colors because I vividly remember the color of mine. So,
before we jump into yours, does your mother and father think that there's any connection between what your grandfather saw and them, since this thing is generational? Is this something that they feel like is there because of your family?
My mom, she didn't know about my grandfather's experience until after hers. And then me and my mom, we talk about our separate experiences. She didn't know about mine until recently. So it's something that we've pieced together over the years, just because it was the weird thing is with the experiences, like they're very like profound and like a huge deal when it's going on, but it seems like shortly after it just leaves your mind and it just kind of slips. Like with the picture that I showed you at Crypticon with the red light in the beam, that happened when my husband was out. We do go to UFO con stuff together. So that's something that he'd be interested in. And normally I'd call him up and be like, hey, I just saw this and I got a video of it and I have pictures of it, but that just didn't even, it totally slipped my mind. And I think it was the next day that I finally showed him the video and the picture. And he's like, why did you hide this from me? It's like, it's not a matter of hiding it. It slipped my mind. He's like, how does something like seeing a light with a beam slip your mind? So it's just interesting how that works. And especially with my mom, like she is usually not very forthcoming about talking about it, but she doesn't shy from it either. I think that it just kind of slips her mind and it's just crazy how that works, but it seems to be what happens.
All right, so let's talk about yours. I'm going to assume that yours is the one you're most familiar with.
Oh yeah. Of course.
So tell me what happened.
So with mine, it's a very Michigander story. I used to hunt with my stepfather a lot. And we went up to Gaylord, which is...
I knew it. I knew the hand was coming up.
Yeah, it's right up north. And so we went there. It was probably early spring. I think we went for spring break because it was before the leaves came in on the trees because we were coon hunting. And so we went out and it was just after dusk. And so we took the dog and we went out to the middle of the woods. We turned off our headlights and let the dog go because you have to sit in the dark and wait, not just because it's creepy and all the critters come crawling out, but because if you have your light on, the dog will come back to you. And so turn off our lights, we're listening to the dog and we're waiting for it to howl. And so we're waiting and it starts howling, and so we start walking towards the noise of the dog. And we're going through these fields and stuff, and it was a full moon out because the fields were like glowing. I remember telling my stepdad, who was with me, how pretty it was, and he kind of just grunted and kept walking. But I thought it was awesome. But anyway, so we get through the first field and then go into the second field, and there was a group of trees that was in the middle of the field. And so we're walking towards it, and we are probably about, let's see, 120 feet away from it when suddenly there was a bright light that just kind of happened. It didn't like fade on, it just turned on. And it was probably about the size of a SUV. And it was a really beautiful, like light purplish blue kind of periwinkle color. And it didn't cast any shadows onto the field. And I'm the one holding the gun, which made me uncomfortable because I know how movies go.
Right.
And so I look up at my stepdad and I'm like, "What is that?" And he's like, "I don't know." And he keeps walking towards it. And I'm thinking, this man's crazy. Like,
Well, you
and at
got the
this
gun, you
time
got him
I'm,
covered.
Shh, no. And so we're walking towards it, and it went up above the trees. And it went at a moderate pace. It wasn't lightning fast, but it was at a moderate pace. It went up above the trees and it hovered there for a bit. And then it was enough for me to stop, look at my stepdad, look back. And then it went up like diagonally. And it was the fastest thing that I've ever seen. It pretty much just streaked. It was like a reverse shooting star. Like it just streaked across and just wasn't there anymore. But it got even worse because he kept walking towards where it was. And all I'm thinking in my mind is, oh my gosh, it's an ET situation. We just interrupted something and they hurried up and left, and there's another ET in there. And that's what the dog is barking at. And so he's like, well, we gotta go see what it is. And so I'm shaking and I'm carrying this gun, and I'm the only one carrying a gun. And so we get into the trees. And so we walk through probably about 5 feet in. And in the middle of this group of trees, all of the trees were laying down counterclockwise in a circle. And in the middle, there was one tree standing. And of course, that's where the dog was at.
Of course.
Of course. And so my stepdad told me, well, shine your light. I'm like, oh, I don't wanna, but I did it anyways. And so I went ahead and I turned on the red light that you have when you're coon hunting, and I worked my way up the tree, praying that there's nothing in it, and I couldn't find anything. He's like, okay, well, do the flashing light so that it looks at you and it will shine. And it's like, so I did get nothing, but the dog won't get off the tree. And that's finally where I drew the line because my stepdad told me, well, go get the dog. It's like, no, I'm not going towards that tree. So I made him go across all of the trees that were down and go grab the dog, and he ended up having to carry it back over, but he had to yank that dog off the tree. And then when we came out of the trees, though, the sun was starting to come up. So when we went out there, the moon had just came out, and then when we left, the sun was coming up. So there's a period of missing time, and everybody was commenting on how, well, it didn't seem like we were in there for that long. It's a lot, it must have been a lot later than we thought it was. So,
And how old were you at this time again?
13,
Okay.
13, maybe 14. So, but yeah, and then my stepdad, he never talked to me about it again. It was just, like I said, it was one of those things that kind of slipped your mind. And it was strange for me because it did slip my mind, but I still remember everything like it was yesterday. Well, everything that I just explained, I still remember it like it was yesterday. I remember the colors and everything like that, but.
So if you went to your stepdad today and you brought this up, would he ignore that it happened, or would he talk about it, or just out of curiosity, would you be on the same wavelength like your parents are?
I don't think so. He's more of the I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. Because like he's aware that he can't explain it, but he doesn't want to investigate it.
I guess that
He's,
makes sense. Do you
yeah.
think that's out of just he's just not into that kind of thing, or do you think he might be a little scared of what he might find out?
I think a little bit both.
Understandable.
Yeah, and so that's why I never really push it with him. But when me and my mom get together, we'll talk about our experiences, and I'm trying to talk her into going to some of the cons with me, but she's more old-fashioned, I guess.
All right, before we get to your sons, I'm curious about something. So, I don't know anybody that coon hunts. What is the purpose of coon hunting? It's not for food, is it? Is it
Oh, some
more
people
just for?
do. Some people do eat coon meat. We used to do it because we'd sell the meat and then we'd also sell the fur. So you'd make probably about $100 on one coon back
Oh,
then.
that makes sense then. I didn't even think about the fur aspect of it. Okay. I was like, I always hear about people coon hunting, but I was like, I never knew anybody to know the purpose of doing it.
Yeah, and it's pretty cool. You go walking through the woods at night. I mean, you run into some weird things, but
But you use two different types of lights. You said to put a red light and then a flashing light.
yeah. When you're coon hunting, you use three different kinds of lights. The red light is so that you can look at stuff without taking away your night vision, because the red light doesn't disturb that. And then the flashing light, since they have reflective pupils, it forces them to look at you, because if you see a flashing light, they're gonna look. And then there's a regular white light, which you shine when you go ahead and shoot.
All right. We'll see. Now I'm learning something.
Yeah.
I don't know that I'll ever use it, but I'm learning it. All right. So let's talk about your son's experience.
I guess.
Yeah.
Okay, so my son's experience, he was probably about 4 or 5 years old. He was pr pretty young. And I, again, he told me about it when he was younger, but I always just kind of, like brushed it off, which is bizarre. But so we were staying at my mother's house, and, when I woke up, he said, there were ghosts in the bedroom last night. I'm like, okay, whatever, and which is a strange response. Okay, whatever. But he's like, no, there were ghosts, Mom. There were ghosts in the bedroom. And he was convinced that they were ghosts. And so he started explaining it to me. He's like, you were asleep and I woke up because the light got in my eyes. He said they came into the bedroom. It was grandma, papa, my sister, and then four other people he didn't know. my sister and my mom and my dad, they're all still alive. So I'm thinking, what is this kid on about? You know, there's not ghosts of people that are alive. But he said that they were floating light that looked like them. And he said that they came in through the bedroom door. They stood at the end of the bed and they were looking at him. And he said that they were judging him. And then they walked out of the room and out the other door and left. And so I talked to him after I talked to you, actually. I'm like, so what color were they? What? I'm like, did it make a shadow? He's like, no, there was no shadows. They were light people that looked like our family. And then the four other ones, they were just lights. He's like, they didn't have a face in them or anything, but the other ones, they had faces. I was like, huh. So, I mean, I could speculate and say that I think that they were probably doing something and wanted him to be relaxed. So maybe that's why they looked like family members. And in his five-year-old mind, they were ghosts. But, I mean, that's all just speculation.
I like that he used the term they were judging him, because yeah. That's not a term that 4 and 5 year olds use, because it's not really part of their vocabulary at that point in life. Mm-hmm. Unless they were, you know, these little pageant girls or something where they're, you know, but you know, a 4 or 5 year old typically doesn't use the term mm-hmm. judging for any reason.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, they were staring at him, I guess. And yeah.
How long ago was that?
And see, he was about 5 and he is 15 now, so 10 years ago.
Does he have a recollection of that today? You said yeah. You were talking to him about it after, so I guess so.
Yeah, I can call him up here if you want.
No, I just thought it was cool that, because, you know, a lot of times when you start talking about younger kids having experiences, mm-hmm. no matter what it is, by the time they start hitting adolescence, they kind of block all of it out.
Oh, yeah. The, I think it's called like pubescent amnesia. It's when they hit a certain age. It knocks out some stuff, but yeah, no, he's still angry about it. He's mad at me because I didn't react to it. It's like, oh, okay, that's nice. And if I even talk to him about it now, he's still mad at me.
Yeah, I can understand that.
Yeah.
My kids, I think all my kids went through the pubescent amnesia, because they tended to forget everything that I had told them about how to behave and how to clean their rooms and all that once they hit a certain age.
Oh yeah, 100%. But he still remembers, because like I said, I talked to him about it because it didn't click until after I had talked to you. It's like, well, okay, if they weren't ghosts, what about if it was the ET or aliens that, like, what about if it was just them? Because they always come in light. Or at least for us, they come in light.
So do you think that your experience mm-hmm. opened you up for maybe other types of visitations? Have you noticed that if you seem to be a little more sensitive towards spirits and stuff like that after your encounter than what you were before?
Yeah, I'd say so. I think definitely it made me more sensitive to that kind of stuff. That, and I showed you the picture of the UFO that was over my house right before I came to the Crypticon. We did live in a haunted house when I was probably about 15. So we had that experience, and then tend to just smell stuff here and there. But nothing major. At least I don't consider it major.
So you said earlier that your father feels like that the UFOs kind of keep track of them. Do you feel that way also?
That's kind of one of the reasons why I want to do the regression, because I don't have any recollection of anything beyond that one night. But then again, my son said I was sleeping during his experience, and then it would be interesting to see. But I don't have any feeling of being followed, or I mean, I get that creepy I'm being watched thing whenever I go outside at night sometimes because I live out in the middle of a field, and but that's just being surrounded by corn.
Yeah, and Sasquatch.
Yeah, well, yep, that too. Well, my one friend that came with us, I think she showed you her Sasquatch footprints that she took.
Yes.
So,
Yeah.
yep, and that's right down the road for me as well. So, I guess there could be something out there watching, but nothing that I'm really concerned about.
Nice. Well, at least you get fresh corn. You know, if you got to put up with Sasquatch and UFOs, at least you got some good food to
Oh, yeah.
offset it a little bit.
Yeah, exactly. A
Morgan, it's been
little
fun. It's fun having you on. I appreciate you coming on. It's taken us a couple of weeks to actually hook up, but yeah, I knew this was a great story, and I think our listeners are going to love it.
awesome. Yep. And if you ever want to reach out and talk more, I'm perfectly fine with it. I mean, like I said, grew up in a haunted house. The friend that came with me, she spent the night one time with us, and we used to call him Jack. He scared the crap out of her. She never came over again. But I mean, we're still friends to this day after 30 years. So I guess it wasn't too bad.
Yeah, she managed to let it go.
Yeah, she forgave me.
All right, dear. Well, I will talk to you soon.
All right, awesome. Thank you so much.
All right, guys, that wraps it up for us this week. Thank you guys so much for everything you do. Merry Christmas to everybody who is listening out there.
Yeah. Have a Merry Christmas and hope Santa's good to you. We love you.